A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this prompt about the transition from breastfeeding to solids. His son Ezra is coming up on a year old, and they're thinking about weaning off breast milk, introducing cow's milk, and figuring out the whole hydration puzzle. He's asking about portion sizes, food rotation, balanced diet at this age, and specifically whether babies can drink water freely, especially in a hot climate like Jerusalem, where milk alone doesn't quite cut it for thirst. There's a lot to unpack here, and honestly, the hydration question alone is something parents get wrong all the time.
They absolutely do, and part of the reason is that the guidance has shifted even in the last decade. The thing that jumps out at me first is that Daniel mentioned Ezra already eats solids and has clear favorites: cottage cheese, pita bread, cucumbers. That's actually a really strong starting point. A baby who's already comfortable with textures and flavors at 11 months is past the biggest hurdle.
The cucumber thing is specific. I respect a baby with a strong vegetable allegiance.
Cucumbers are mostly water, which is relevant to the hydration question we'll get to. But let's start with the transition itself, because there's a physiological shift happening here that most parents don't think about explicitly. Around 12 months, a baby's digestive system is mature enough to handle cow's milk as a primary drink rather than just an ingredient in food. Before that, the proteins in cow's milk can be hard on the kidneys and can irritate the gut lining. After 12 months, that risk drops off significantly.
The one-year mark isn't arbitrary. It's not just a nice round number for birthday parties.
The American Academy of Pediatrics and the CDC both draw the line at 12 months for introducing cow's milk as a main drink. Before that, breast milk or formula should be the primary source of nutrition. After 12 months, you can switch to whole cow's milk. And I want to emphasize whole milk, not reduced fat, not skim. The fat is critical for brain development at this age.
I feel like the fat-free everything era really did a number on parental intuition here. People hear milk and reach for the low-fat version because that's what they drink themselves. I remember our aunt doing exactly that with our cousin. She was so deep in the 90s skim milk mindset that she couldn't believe the pediatrician was telling her to give a toddler whole milk. She thought it was a mistake.
That's exactly the kind of misconception that shows up in practice, and I've seen it dozens of times. Parents come in, and they're almost apologetic, like, "I know whole milk has more fat. Shouldn't I be giving the healthier version?" And I have to explain that healthier for a 40-year-old and healthier for a 1-year-old are completely different equations. The CDC guidance is explicit: whole milk until age 2, because the fatty acids are essential for myelination, which is the process of insulating nerve fibers in the brain. You're literally building brain infrastructure with those fats. Switching to low fat too early is depriving a developing brain of building materials.
The brain is basically under construction, and you're withholding the drywall.
That's a very corn way of putting it, but yes. Now, the transition itself, the prompt asks about portion sizes and how to judge what's appropriate. And this is where things get interesting, because the standard advice is, let the baby self-regulate, which is simultaneously true and completely unhelpful.
Let the baby self-regulate sounds like the nutritional equivalent of just be yourself. Technically correct, practically meaningless. What does that even look like at 6:30 on a Tuesday, when you're exhausted and the baby is flinging cottage cheese at the wall?
That's precisely the problem. I want to give a more concrete answer than that, because I've seen parents genuinely anxious about whether they're feeding too much or too little. Here's what the research actually shows. At around 12 months, a baby needs roughly 900 to 10,000 calories per day. About half of that should still come from breast milk or whole cow's milk, so roughly 16 to 24 ounces of milk per day. The other half comes from solid foods.
That's actually a helpful benchmark. Half and half, roughly, so you can do the math in your head without a spreadsheet.
The key insight, and this is the part that gets missed constantly, is that the milk intake should actually start decreasing as solids increase. A common mistake is continuing the same volume of milk while adding more solids on top, and then wondering why the baby is refusing food or gaining weight too rapidly. The transition is a substitution, not an addition.
That's the part nobody says out loud. Everyone talks about introducing solids like it's a bonus round, but you're actually rebalancing the whole equation. You're not adding a side dish to the milk meal. You're gradually flipping the ratio.
And if you don't make that mental shift, you end up with a 14-month-old who's drinking 30 ounces of whole milk a day plus 3 meals, and that's how you get iron deficiency, because milk is low in iron and the sheer volume crowds out iron-rich foods. I've seen that exact pattern more times than I can count. The toddler comes in, they're pale, they're irritable, the parents say they're a picky eater, but really they're just full of milk all day.
The iron deficiency isn't a mystery, it's a math problem.
It's often a math problem. And the portion size question, here's a practical framework. At 12 months, a typical portion might be about a quarter of an adult portion, so if you're having a cup of pasta, the baby gets a quarter cup. A tablespoon of each food type per meal is a reasonable starting point. But you watch the baby's cues. If they're turning their head away, closing their mouth, pushing food away, that's satiety. If they're leaning forward, opening their mouth, reaching, that's hunger. The self-regulation thing is real, but it works through observable signals, not telepathy.
You're not measuring milliliters with a graduated cylinder. You're reading behavior.
And the research on baby-led weaning, which is the approach where you skip purees and go straight to soft finger foods, shows that babies are surprisingly good at self-regulating calorie intake when they're allowed to control the pace. A study from the University of Nottingham a few years back found that babies who did baby-led weaning were no more likely to be underweight or overweight than spoon-fed babies, and they tended to have a better ability to stop eating when full.
Which tracks with what Daniel described. Ezra's already eating pita bread and cucumbers and cottage cheese. He's past the puree stage. So the question isn't, how do we start solids? It's how do we complete the transition away from breastfeeding?
And the weaning process itself. Hannah wants to stop breastfeeding soon, and Daniel described it as a relief for all of us. That's worth acknowledging. Weaning is emotionally complicated, but it's also physically demanding to be the sole source of nutrition for nearly a year. There's a reason the World Health Organization recommends breastfeeding for 2 years or beyond, and also a reason why most mothers in developed countries don't go that long. The ideal and the realistic are different things.
The WHO recommendation is global. It accounts for contexts where clean water and reliable food supply aren't guaranteed. In a place like Jerusalem with safe water and access to varied foods, the calculus shifts.
That's a fair point. The WHO guideline is partly a public health hedge against food insecurity and waterborne illness. In a setting with safe water, refrigeration, and access to nutritious food, the urgency of extended breastfeeding is lower. But the immunological benefits are real regardless of setting. Breast milk continues to provide antibodies and immune support as long as it's produced. So you're making a trade-off, not just checking a box.
How do you actually do the weaning? Drop one feed at a time.
That's the standard approach, and it works well for most families. You replace one breastfeeding session with a cup of whole milk or a solid meal, wait a few days to let the baby adjust, and to let the mother's supply adjust, because stopping abruptly is painful and risks mastitis. Then drop another feed. The whole process might take a few weeks to a couple of months. The morning and bedtime feeds are usually the last to go, because they're the most comforting and routine-bound.
What does a few days mean in practice? How do you know when it's time to drop the next one?
3 to 5 days is a reasonable window. You're looking for two things. The baby is accepting the replacement feed without excessive fussing, and the mother isn't experiencing engorgement or discomfort. If either of those isn't true, you wait longer. The body needs time to down-regulate note production, and that's a hormonal process that can't be rushed. I've seen mothers try to drop 3 feeds in a week because they're just done, and they end up with mastitis, which is not only painful but can require antibiotics. Slower is faster.
The prompt mentions cow's milk coming in. So you're essentially swapping breast milk for whole cow's milk in a cup, 1 feed at a time.
And the cup part matters enormously. By 12 months, the goal is to transition away from bottles entirely. Prolonged bottle use is associated with tooth decay, because milk pools around the teeth, especially if the child falls asleep with a bottle, and with iron deficiency, because kids fill up on milk and eat less iron-rich food. The CDC and the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry both recommend weaning off bottles by 12 to 18 months.
Bottle to cup is happening in parallel with breast to cow's milk. Two transitions at once. That feels like a lot to coordinate.
Which is why it's smart to introduce the cup well before you need it. If a baby's already comfortable drinking water from a sippy cup or an open cup by 10 or 11 months, the milk transition is much smoother. You're not introducing a new vessel and a new liquid simultaneously. It's like you don't learn to drive a manual transmission and navigate a new city on the same day. You learn the skill first, then apply it.
That's a surprisingly apt analogy. Let's talk about food rotation and balanced diet, because that was another part of the prompt. Daniel mentioned Ezra's favorites. Cottage cheese, pita bread, cucumber. How do you build out from a limited set of accepted foods to something that resembles a balanced diet?
The principle is repeated exposure without pressure. Research consistently shows that it can take 8 to 15 exposures to a new food before a baby accepts it. And exposure doesn't even mean eating it. It can mean seeing it on the plate, touching it, smelling it. The mistake parents make is offering something twice, having it rejected, and concluding, "My baby doesn't like broccoli." No, your baby doesn't know what broccoli is yet. They need time.
The rotation isn't Monday is chicken, Tuesday is lentils. It's more like broccoli keeps showing up on this plate, and eventually I'll investigate it.
And you pair new foods with accepted foods. If Ezra loves cottage cheese and pita, you put the new food alongside those. The familiarity of the favorites makes the whole plate feel safe. You're not tricking the baby, you're scaffolding. And you're not making a big deal of it. No, come on, just try one bite, it's so good for you. You put it there, you eat your own food, you let the baby watch you eating the same thing. Modeling is probably the most underrated intervention in pediatric nutrition.
Does the modeling actually work at this age? A 12-month-old is paying that much attention to what's on your plate.
It works better than almost anything else. Babies are extraordinarily attentive to social cues around food. There's a fascinating body of research on what's called social referencing. Babies look at their caregivers' facial expressions to determine whether a food is safe or desirable. If you're eating broccoli with a relaxed, neutral expression, you're sending a signal that this is normal and fine. If you're doing the airplane spoon and the exaggerated yum, you're actually signaling that this food requires a sales pitch, which can backfire.
The airplane spoon as a signal of desperation. I love that. So the parent's job is basically to be a very boring broccoli-eating role model.
Don't perform. It's counterintuitive, but the data supports it. Scaffolding is a good word for it. What about the nutritional composition? What does balanced actually mean for a 12-month-old? The framework is the same as for adults, just scaled down and with some specific emphases. You want iron-rich foods. That's critical at this age, because iron stores from birth are depleting and breast milk is low in iron. Meat, lentils, fortified cereals, spinach. You want healthy fats, avocado, full-fat yogurt, olive oil. You want a variety of fruits and vegetables for vitamins and fiber. And you want to be thoughtful about choking hazards. Whole grapes, nuts, popcorn, chunks of raw vegetables that are too hard.
Cucumber seems like it'd be on the choking hazard list, but Daniel said it's a favorite. I'm guessing it's prepared in a specific way.
For an 11-month-old with teeth, cucumber can be served in thin spears or grated. The spear approach actually works well. They can hold it and gnaw on it, and the high water content makes it less of a choking risk than something like a raw carrot, which is denser and can snap into a plug-shaped piece. But you're right to flag it. Anything firm and round needs modification. The rule of thumb is that if a food is roughly the diameter of a child's airway, it needs to be quartered or shredded or cooked soft.
The airway diameter test. That's the kind of concrete thing parents can actually visualize.
It's roughly the diameter of a hot dog, which is why hot dogs are one of the most common choking hazards for toddlers. They're exactly the wrong shape. If you're going to serve them, slice them lengthwise into quarters, not into coins.
We've covered portion sizes. Roughly a quarter of adult portions, a tablespoon per food type. Let the baby's cues guide you. We've covered rotation, repeated exposure, pair new with familiar, don't give up after two rejections. We've covered the cow's milk transition, whole milk, 12 months, cup not bottle, one feed at a time. Let's get to the hydration question, because I think this is where things get interesting.
This is the part I was most excited to dig into, because the conventional wisdom on water for infants has shifted, and a lot of parents are still operating on outdated advice.
The old rule was, no water before 6 months, right? Something about electrolyte imbalance.
Yes, and that part is still correct. Before 6 months, exclusively breastfed babies don't need water. Breast milk is about 88% water and provides complete hydration. Giving water to a young infant can displace milk and lead to inadequate calorie intake, and in rare cases can cause water intoxication, where sodium levels drop dangerously low. So the no water before 6 months rule is solid.
Ezra is almost 12 months. That rule is ancient history.
Between 6 and 12 months, small amounts of water are fine. A few sips with meals, primarily to get the baby used to drinking from a cup. But after 12 months, water should be freely available. The prompt asks, can they drink water freely at this point? And the answer is an emphatic yes. In fact, water should be the primary thirst quencher, with whole milk serving as a nutritional beverage rather than a hydration solution.
Daniel made a specific point about this. Milk is caloric and, in a hot climate, doesn't quench thirst as well. He's exactly right.
He's right on both counts. Whole milk is about 150 calories per cup. If a toddler is drinking milk every time they're thirsty on a hot Jerusalem summer day, they could easily consume an extra 300 to 450 calories just in milk, which either displaces solid food or leads to excessive weight gain. And milk doesn't trigger the same thirst-quenching mechanisms that water does. There's a reason marathon runners aren't handed cups of whole milk at the hydration stations.
The mental image of a marathon aid station handing out whole milk is deeply unsettling.
It's the gastrointestinal equivalent of a dare. But to the serious point, in hot climates, water is essential. Dehydration in toddlers happens faster than adults realize. They have a higher surface area to body mass ratio, so they lose water through the skin more quickly. Their thirst mechanism isn't as well developed, so they may not recognize or communicate thirst effectively. And they can't exactly walk over to the tap and say, "I need a glass of water."
The practical advice is, water should be available throughout the day, especially in summer, and especially in Jerusalem where temperatures can push past 35 degrees Celsius.
Keep a sippy cup or a small open cup of water accessible. Offer it regularly, not just at mealtimes. And watch for signs of adequate hydration. The baby should have 4 to 6 wet diapers a day. The urine should be pale yellow, not dark or strong smelling. Those are the real indicators, not a specific number of ounces.
What about the flip side? Can a toddler drink too much water?
It's much harder to overdo water at this age compared to infancy, but excessive water intake can still displace milk and food. If a toddler is drinking so much water that they're not hungry for meals, that's a problem. The general guideline is that water shouldn't exceed about 8 to 12 ounces a day beyond what they get from milk and food. But in a hot climate, that number flexes upward. You're looking for balance, not a strict cap.
If Ezra's outside in the Jerusalem summer, running around eating pita and cucumber, he should have water available, and the volume is going to be higher than it would be for a baby in, say, Storrs, Connecticut in November.
I appreciate the Storrs reference. And yes, climate matters enormously. This is where universal guidelines need local interpretation. The CDC and NHS recommendations are written with temperate climates in mind. Parents in hot climates need to adjust upward on water and watch their kids more carefully for dehydration signs. I'll add something specific to the Jerusalem context. The combination of heat and dry air means evaporative water loss through the skin is higher than in a humid, hot climate. You might not see the baby sweating visibly, but they're still losing water.
That's a really important distinction. People think, if they're not dripping sweat, they're fine. But in a dry climate, the sweat evaporates so fast you never see it.
And that invisible water loss can catch parents off guard, so the diaper count and urine color are your objective measures. Don't rely on visible sweating.
Let me ask a question. I think a lot of parents have, but don't articulate. Is there a risk that offering water makes the baby feel full, and then they don't drink enough milk, and now you've got a calorie deficit?
That's a legitimate concern, and it's why timing matters. Offer water between meals and during meals, but not immediately before a milk feed. If you give a full cup of water 5 minutes before a breastfeeding session or a cup of milk, yes, the baby might take less. But if water is available throughout the day in small amounts, it doesn't usually interfere with milk intake. The stomach empties water quickly. It's not sitting there for hours. Water passes through the stomach in maybe 20 to 30 minutes, whereas milk with its fat and protein content takes longer to digest.
It's not water or milk. It's water in the background, milk at designated times.
That's exactly the framing. And as breastfeeding winds down, those designated milk times become whole milk in a cup times. The rhythm of the day might be something like morning milk, breakfast with water, mid-morning water, lunch with water, afternoon snack with water, dinner with water, bedtime milk. The meal bookends the day, and water handles hydration in between.
I want to circle back to something Daniel mentioned about cottage cheese. That's an interesting favorite food for a baby. And I wonder if there's something to it nutritionally.
Cottage cheese is actually an excellent baby food. It's high in protein, it's got calcium and phosphorus for bone development, it's soft and easy to eat, and it's relatively low in sodium compared to other cheeses. The fact that Ezra gravitates toward it suggests he's getting something his body needs. Babies do have some innate ability to seek out nutrients. It's not fully understood, but there's evidence that they can self-select a surprisingly balanced diet over time if offered a variety of healthy options.
The famous baby chooses their own diet. Study. That was Clara Davis in the 1920s, right?
Davis offered newly weaned infants a selection of 34 whole foods, and these were things like bone marrow, liver, turnips, bananas, haddock, and let them eat whatever they wanted, no adult intervention. The results were remarkable. The babies chose wildly different diets from each other and from meal to meal, but over time, they all converged on nutritionally adequate intake. One baby with rickets even selected cod liver oil until the deficiency resolved, then stopped. The study has methodological flaws by modern standards, but the core finding, that infants have some intrinsic capacity for nutritional self-regulation, has held up.
If Ezra's going hard on cottage cheese, it might be because his body wants the protein and fat. And the cucumber thing, that might just be because cucumbers are refreshing, or it might be a hydration drive expressing itself through food preference.
That's speculative, but plausible. Cucumbers are over 95% water. In a hot climate, a preference for high water foods makes physiological sense. Watermelon, cucumber, oranges, these are nature's hydration packets.
Nature's hydration packets. I'm gonna use that.
You're welcome to it. Now, I want to address something that wasn't explicitly in the prompt, but is probably on Daniel and Hannah's minds. What about allergies? When you're transitioning to a full solid food diet, you're introducing a lot of new proteins, and the guidance on allergen introduction has completely flipped in the last decade.
The old advice was to delay peanuts, eggs, shellfish. Keep them away until the immune system is more mature. And now it's the opposite.
The landmark LEAP study, Learning Early, about peanut allergy, published in 2015, showed that early introduction of peanuts to high-risk infants reduced peanut allergy by up to 86% compared to avoidance. The evidence was so strong that the NIH and the American Academy of Pediatrics both revised their guidelines. Now, the recommendation is to introduce common allergens, peanuts, eggs, dairy, wheat, soy, fish, shellfish, starting around 6 months and continuing regularly.
Daniel mentioned cottage cheese and pita bread, so dairy and wheat are already in the rotation. Those are two of the big ones.
If Ezra's been eating those without reaction, that's great. The ones to be intentional about introducing are peanuts, eggs, and fish or shellfish. The current guidance is to offer a small amount, wait a few days to observe for any reaction, and if there's no issue, keep offering it regularly, a couple of times a week, to maintain tolerance.
What about the fear factor? Parents here introduce allergens early, and they're picturing anaphylaxis at the dinner table.
Severe reactions on first exposure are actually very rare. Most allergic reactions are mild. A rash, some hives, maybe some vomiting. And the risk of a severe reaction is far lower with early introduction than it is with delayed introduction followed by accidental exposure later. The data on this is really clear. Early and regular exposure is protective. Think of it as the immune system learning that these proteins are normal environmental features, not threats. If you delay introduction, the first encounter might happen at a birthday party when the kid is 3, and the immune system has had years to develop a more robust defensive posture.
The advice is basically, don't let fear of a 1 in 1,000 reaction prevent you from doing the thing that prevents the 1 in 100 outcome.
For parents who are really anxious, you can start with a tiny amount, a smear of peanut butter on a piece of pita, a small piece of scrambled egg, and increase gradually. You don't have to hand the baby a spoonful of peanut butter on day 1. You can also do it in the parking lot of the pediatrician's office if that helps you feel more secure. I've had parents do exactly that.
The parking lot introduction strategy. That feels like one of those things that sounds absurd, but is actually completely reasonable if it gets the job done.
It is completely reasonable. The goal is early and regular exposure. The location doesn't matter. If doing it within sight of medical care reduces parental anxiety enough to actually follow through, then do it in the parking lot.
Let's pull this all together, because we've covered a lot of ground. The transition from breastfeeding to solids and cow's milk at 12 months, it's a substitution, not an addition. Portion sizes are about a quarter of adult portions, guided by the baby's own hunger and fullness cues. Food rotation is about repeated exposure without pressure. Put the new thing next to the cottage cheese and pita, and let curiosity do the work. Balanced diet means iron, healthy fats, variety, and attention to choking hazards. Cow's milk should be whole milk in a cup, not a bottle. And water should be freely available, especially in a hot climate, with milk serving as nutrition and water serving as hydration.
That's a solid summary. I'd add one more thing. The weaning process itself is not just nutritional, it's emotional. For nearly a year, breastfeeding has been a source of comfort, connection, and routine. Replacing that with a cup of milk is a physical transition, but it's also a relational one. The baby needs new forms of comfort and connection, more cuddling, more eye contact during feeding, more patience during the adjustment. You're not just changing what goes into the baby, you're changing how the baby experiences being cared for.
That's a Herman Poppleberry special, the pediatrician who remembers that medicine happens in the context of relationships.
It's the thing they don't teach enough in medical school. You can get the ounces and the calories exactly right and still have a rough transition if you're not attending to the emotional side. And the mother's experience matters too. Stopping breastfeeding involves a hormonal shift. Prolactin and oxytocin levels drop, and that can affect mood. It's normal to feel a mix of relief and sadness. It's not a failure to feel both.
I think that's an important note to end the substantive discussion on. The numbers matter, but they're not the whole story.
Should we see what Hilbert has for us today?
I believe it's that time. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1954, researchers mapping fungal mycelial networks in British Somaliland discovered a single armillaria colony spanning just under 2 miles across, a distance roughly equivalent to the length of 3,700 adult Somali wild asses standing nose to tail.
I have so many questions about the unit of measurement.
The Somali wild ass as a standardized unit. Hilbert, that's...
Were there 3,700 Somali wild asses just? Did someone line them up? Was this a planned measurement, or did they just happen to have a line of wild asses and thought, well, while we're here?
I'm now picturing a very confused team of British researchers in 1954 Somaliland trying to convince local herders to arrange their donkeys end-to-end for fungal colony documentation purposes.
It's for science, sir. The fungus demands it.
That's going to sit with me for a while.
This has been My Weird Prompts, with me, Herman Poppleberry, and my brother Corn, produced by the inscrutable Hilbert Flemingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find the show.
If you've got a prompt you want us to tackle, send it over at myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon. Until then, offer the cucumber. Trust the cucumber.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.